Well, let's look at Jung's interpretation of that fairy tale, because it's so relevant to the Sophia. I'm not going to read you everything. I'll just try to pick up the main points, but I will read you maybe the first two paragraphs completely. Now, he says, now, what insight can we gain from this fairy tale? I skipped a little bit. As at the beginning of many dreams, something is said about the scene of the dream action. So the fairy tale mentions the forest as the place of the magic happening. The forest, dark and impenetrable to the eye, like deep water and sea, is the container of the unknown and the mysterious. It is an appropriate synonym for the unconscious. So that would be what we've talked about, the dark aspect of the Sophia experience. Among the many trees, the living elements that make up the forest, one tree is especially conspicuous for its great size. Trees, like fishes in the water, represent the living contents of the unconscious. Among these contents, one of special significance is characterized as an oak. Trees have individuality. So you see, there you've got that image of individuality. And the growth process of the tree is the growth process of individuality, out of which something crystallizes. A tree, therefore, is often a symbol of personality. Well, that's what we've been talking about, though I've called it identity. Ludwig Seconds. The mighty oak is proverbially the king of the forest. Hence, it represents a central figure among the contents of the unconscious, possessing personality in the most marked degree. It is the prototype of the self, a symbol of the source and goal of the individuation process. Skip a little bit here. The secret is hidden not in the top, but in the roots of the tree. Now, here's where it's a little different from the dream, but I think a pure Sophia experience is something that's been rooted in the earth, as this fairy tale is. So the secret is hidden not in the top, but in the roots of the tree. And since it is or has a personality, it also possesses the most striking marks of personality, voice, speech, and conscious purpose. Its roots extend into the inorganic realm, into the mineral kingdom. In psychological terms, this would mean that the self has its roots in the body. That's one thing I wanted to get to. Indeed, in the body's chemical elements. So that is so much what we've been talking about in the Sophia experience, that it starts with a physiological experience. You may be experiencing emotionally, but it's a desire which, of course, has its roots in your body. So the tree is a process that starts in the body, and the spirit of Mercurius is embedded in that thing, which is what we have said. We have to pluck the meaning out of an emotional / physiological experience. And that meaning would be Mercurius, roughly speaking. It's more than that, of course. But in the parallel in the dream would be the child. And in our text, it would be the self that crystallizes out of the experience. And why masculine? Because when the experience leads you this far, you are moved to behave differently. And that movement is the masculine active result of having gone through the experience. But he goes on for about 10 pages. I think the second time, I'll post this, I'll scan this in and post this on my website. If you want to read it, you can. It'll be in with the rest of the stuff under the Aurora material. You can read it rather than take up our time.
Is that in the Collected Works?
This is Collected Works 13. Starts on page 193. So parallel to our text is the fact that the spirit was buried and is mad, like the candle was removed. So this is an aspect of life which is not immediately available to us, in which has been banished from conscious acceptance. both of them. Where in the dream, it wasn't quite so much so. Because it for the dreamer, it was not a physiological experience. It was more of a generalized several-year period of malaise. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I could mention. I think that's... You can read further if you like. And that's, I think, all I wanted to... Is that all I wanted to do? We left off then with Carol's question, which it's interesting how these questions appear. What's the relationship between Sophia and Christ? And that is actually the theme of the next chapter, so I'm going to not try to answer that, but we'll be addressing that as we go along. Hopefully what I've said will have given you a little more practical feel for what we're talking about. I always feel that's so important, to not just talk about these images, but that you can actually see, what does that look like in somebody when they have a Sophia dream, when they're going through a Sophia experience? What we're really aiming for ultimately is behavior change. How does that behavior look? And how does it come about? That's what I wanted to try to communicate to you by way of that dream. Okay. I think then we left off at the bottom of 267. Any questions you want to look over? Bottom of 267. For this generation cometh and passeth away until he come that is to be sent, who also taketh away the yoke of our captivity, wherein we sate 70 years by the rivers of Babylon. That would be reference to the Jewish captivity by Babylon in the Old Testament. There we wept and hung up our instruments. The images that we'll be looking at is captivity again. Babylon. And we. We wept. See, suddenly it goes from I to we. And I think we can combine two passages together because they're quite related. Let's go over to 269. I'll read you that passage, and then we'll look at the two passages together. Because the daughters of Zion were haughty and walk with stretched out necks and wrinklings of their eyes, and made a noise and went at a measured pace. Therefore the Lord will make bald the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and will discover their hair. For the law shall come forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And the image there is the daughters of Zion. That's the we. Captivity. Nothing new. 268 at the top. The unredeemed state of the anima in matter is here expressed figuratively as a captivity. That's been the discussion we've had all along with the prison idea. And that's simply that the difference between an experience and a me. So nothing.
And what is he done? I mean, and he keeps regressing back, correct?
Absolutely.
He won't move forward. So where? What is he doing here? I mean, how is that showing up?
I don't think it shows up yet. Let me see.
The previous one, you kept going back to the...
Yeah.
That's okay if we're not there yet.
No, I it's an important question.
Doesn't it kind of say it in the end of that first paragraph on 268 where it talks about that it signified confusion and evil thoughts which confound the heart? The rivers of Babylon mentioned in the text were interpreted as the church as the streams of lust. I mean, he's going back to that. And then the very last sentence, these implications show that the author's anima is still overpowered, or at least oppressed by the shadow elements from which she can be cleansed only by the...
But that's not the...
is that talking about Sophia?
That's not the regression.
That's not the regression.
Uh-oh. I don't know. I'm trying to see if we actually get the regression in this chapter. So clearly... I don't think it's so clearly expressed. In a way, I guess you could kind of say that it's implied because he hasn't moved forward. He's still back. But the problem is that that's not what I would call the real regression. The real regression I would call is when he tries to move forward, he moves forward by interpreting the experience in the Christian framework. And that comes up most clearly in the next chapter. Because Sophia then is equated to Christ. And that's what we'll be talking about. That's really what your question is. But Sophia isn't Christ. There are definite overlaps, which is why he can, with some good conscience, make that link, but not completely. The regression in the sense of loss of conscious orientation isn't undesirable. That's one of the implications of this experience. You need to be dissolved. It's when you can't make sense of that to move forward to the new genuine selfhood that I would then say that's a regression that's undesirable.
See, so when he's coming up with all this loss and everything, going back to what Patty said, that's where he needs to sit and be with that, right?
Right. That itself is desirable.
Right.
And that that is the positive aspect of the regression in this text.
Right.
That they are taken to Babylon, because that's exactly what this guy has ignored his whole life. Remember, his parents sent a courtesan to lure him out of the church, and he pulled a brand out of the fire and said, get away. He absolutely refused any contact with desirousness, apparently throughout his whole life. And then he is a metaphor for the church's asceticism and anti-body stance. We can watch how that general attitude has taken hold in him personally, how it's trying to transform in him personally, and then how it's really meant to transform the church in general. So that he's sort of a microcosm.
So instead of really sitting with that and allowing that healing to take place with all this stuff, whatever's in that, he keeps going back to like the Christ or going back to...
He'll say, something comes to rescue me out of this experience, and that's Christ. Mm-hmm. Rather than saying a meaning is trying to evolve through this experience, and it has certain characteristics of Christ, but it also has certain characteristics which are not Christ. And that is what we'll be talking about in the next chapter. How is Sophia and Christ different? How is this experience, how is what evolves out of this experience, how is that Mercurius, and how is that child somewhat Christ-like and somewhat not Christ-like? Well, Mercurius, for example, would be that the new attitude that is trying to emerge out of the experience. Mercurius would be the meaning that's trying to emerge out of experience. But compare Mercurius and Christ. Mercurius is a trickster. Christ is never a trickster. Mercurius is physical and spiritual. Christ is spiritual. Mercurius is just downright bad sometimes. And Christ is not bad. So they're, as far as Jung's concerned, Mercurius and Sophia are the wider dimension of human experience that the church has narrowed down. And what the text is trying to get Thomas to do is open up to see, really, that Christ is a bigger phenomenon than he and the church have allowed us to see. So captivity, then, is, again, the meaning is repressed. And the Babylon theme is simply the desiredness we've talked about. And so we're not hearing anything new, we're just seeing different images. And I like so much what she said that you refer to in 268. Go down to the end of the first paragraph. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up here. This just says it so succinctly. Here we have another allusion to the theme of concupiscentia. A concupiscentia was desirousness, really unbridled desirousness, which was mentioned in the first chapter as a concomitant of wisdom. Now, if you compare that with the Christian idea, Christ accepts the sinners, but purifies them. Where for Sophia, the salvation emerges through the impurity. That's the difference. And that you do not get wisdom without the sin. Without the concupiscentia is a sin. Without the mistake, without the emotional chaos. That is the way to Sophia. That is what, again, is so different between Christ and Sophia. Where does the Bible say you have to get to Christ through sin? You can have sin and you can get to Christ. But this is saying the only way to Sophia is through sin. Concomitant. I don't know if you've ever been to Florence and gone to the... What's the... it's a cupola that has the... was it Brunelleschi and somebody else did the... copper etchings that were...
The doors?
Yeah, the doors.
The
baptistry. Yeah, the baptistry. If you go inside the baptistry, the first layer of the cupola, I guess it would be, is medieval art. And the second layer is Renaissance art. And the first is dark and sin laden, and the people are afraid and almost hunched over with oppression. And then comes this great Renaissance art, which is colorful and playful, and that's the distinction that where the medieval idea is that all that sin is bad. The Sophia idea is all that stuff is the way. That's the difference. It's not what is excluded. It's what you start with. And, of course, this is compensatory to that medieval worldview. Okay. The other theme is we. There we wept. And that is simply the fragmented nature of the beginning of the Sophia experience. Hopefully that's familiar by now. Do I need to repeat any of that, or does that make sense? We're just getting a repeat, but in different words. When you are gripped by that emotion, by your concupiscentia, when you're in your Babylon, you're fragmented. You're driven. You're at odds with yourself. You're confused. And the work is a gathering together, plucking out of all the contradictory feelings you have the singular meaning of this experience. You may love the person, you may hate the person, you may miss the job, you may hate the job. It's this back and forth. When these emotions hit, you are filled with contradictions. Your emotional life is very contradictory. But the idea is that there is a singular meaning trying to emerge through those contradictions.
And that would be the rivers flowing through the midst. Was that on the next page? If you hang in there, then that does, is it the clarity that comes through?
Let's see.
At the top of the other page here.
Among
the stream of ocean. Because that reminds me of like Revelations 22, you know, the rivers flowing from the temple.
Yeah.
And Ezekiel 47, it filled up the fourth man and the...
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
The fourth woman.
The daughters of Zion. We are told a little later proud... seven proud women who were condemned for their pride and desirousness to infertility. Now, in the text, in the biblical text, they are sinners. But here again, they're the doorway. So these biblical images reappear, but they're reevaluated.
Now, is that where kind of Sophia comes in as the whore of Babylon? Is she the whore in Revelation? I mean, is that kind of the Babylon thing too in Revelation?
I would say the whore of Babylon in Revelations would be the concupiscentia, which is the beginning of the Sophia experience. Yeah, and that is right in Revelation, because those of you who, I see you have the archetype of the apocalypse here. What Edinger makes of that is in the text, she carries her filth and abominations in a golden cup. And he said, that's an awfully interesting image. Why would the most despicable be carried in the most valuable? Well, because it is hinting at the need for a reevaluation of what has been called despicable. And that's what, as you can see, that's what this experience is doing. It reevaluates all those things which the church has said is wrong as gateways to spirituality.
And also the water, again, is like in that, just above that is in here, is also the mandala, you know, the New Jerusalem coming. It says, then he just showed me the river of life rising from the throne of God.
Yeah.
And flowing crystal clear.
Right.
Yeah.
You see, you do have these images in the biblical accounts, but this stuff reverses where it comes from. In that case, it comes from the heavenly Jerusalem. But here, it comes out of the banished whores. Mm-hmm. It's a complete reversal. And it's trying to bridge what has previously been separated. Which is why it's so important. And why it was such a threat to the poor guy who was having these experiences in the 13th, 14th century. I mean, still today, if you talk about this in many public places, you'd be crucified. And this was, 600 years ago, 700 years ago, this was experienced. So you can see what a terrific burden it was to the person who had it. And in the text, page 269, these women are yearning for one husband. Meaning that the fragmentation of the experience has a impulse towards synthesis. If you accept the chaos, you begin to be led toward that crystallized self. That's what the conscious personality does not understand. It feels lost and doesn't realize in that lostness is a counteraction towards unity. And that, of course, is what the therapist has to provide. And that's why it's so important to know these images, because you see that push toward unity in these unconscious images, like that child, where the conscious person just feels their life's a mess. And you can say, but wait, look what's growing here.
Jerry, what's the turba when you refer to
that? That's an alchemical text from, I forget from where.
What does it mean?
I don't know. I'll have to check. I looked it up once, but I've forgotten. It's Turba Philosophorum, so it's something of the philosophers, but I don't remember.
Symbolizes the intentional fixing.
Well, yeah, the fixing would be the meaning. Okay. That, again, with same ideas now, it's just going to be driven home to us again and again and again in different images.
Well, what I like, though, is that it is in different images, so you get an idea, it's just not one.
And again, you know, with material like this where it is not understood, like in those dreams of Pali that I'm working on, where he did not understand it, it's so frustrating because, Jesus, don't you ever get it. But because they don't get it, he keeps coming back, and it gives you all the variety of images that the psyche has at its disposal for expressing this.
Which helps us.
Which actually helps us, right.
Gary, could I ask you to just maybe say a few things about that image of the hair on the head of the daughters of Zion that's up in that quote, and they'll just go over their hair. The Lord will make bald the way. Yeah.
Where is that again? I remember reading
that quote on 269, up in the text.
The Lord will make bald the crown.
Because the daughters of Zion were haughty. And then...
Hair was adornment, wasn't it? Hair was just...
Well, it's a sign of the feminine, I know that. Right.
Well, I think, again... Pardon?
This is power, too, isn't it?
Yeah. See, that's the remnant of the old standpoint. That vision says two things at the same time. Two contradictory things. One, it shows these women in a negative light, which is they're the unconscious of, let's say, Thomas, is largely in agreement with the patriarchal worldview. These women deserve to be punished. And yet at the same time, it throws in an image that these women are reaching for unity. And that's the nature of the unconscious. It does two contradictory things at the same time, very often. So that is not a desirable image, that they have been shaved. That's a mark of their punishment. And yet, like the whore of Babylon having the filth and abomination in a golden cup, these very despised and punished women are shown doing a very creative thing, reaching for unity.
Yeah, it says they'll be shaved, but then it also says they will discover their hair. So it's like...
That's what the television is.
Yeah.
Losing it, they'll find it. But see, I think when they find it, that means they're going to be good girls.
Oh.
They will abide by the law.
The law shall come forth.
Yeah.
And just think, they had used to cut off the, well, up to very recent times, they cut the hair of adulterous women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the sense that it's meant in, that these women are being punished. And someday they will see the error of their ways, and they will endure their punishment, and they will begin to follow God's law. But at the same time, the text shows them doing something very creative.
Jim, can we think of what's trying to emerge as the transcendent function? Can we call it that? Holding the opposite?
Yeah.
The true image is coming, and that's what Jung would call the transcendent
function. Yeah, that's a transcendent function. Transcendent function is Jung's word for, think of some of the words we've used, the intent of the instinct. What else have we said? That the child in the tree. Mercurius is Jung's classical image for the transcendent function. The transcendent function, in other words, would be the tendency of the unconscious to lead you where you need to go. And that works by it gets activated when you are consciously accepting your fragmentation, and it brings you into a unitary state over time. Now, what is unique here is that transcendent function takes its origin in a physiological beginning. That's what's so special about the Sophia experience. As we said, in sex, aggression, depression, and disease. That's how I've tried to sum it up. Very, maybe even too succinctly, but. And you can actually see the difference. Like in that dream, that baby was not in the ground. It was above. So that was not somebody who's wrestling with sex or aggression, but just somebody whose experience is going a different way. Why does it go one way for some people and one way for the other? I don't have a clue. It just goes in different ways. And you've got to be able to recognize which way it's going, where it's taking its start. And I never ask myself why. I always ask myself, where is it going? That's a little bit the difference between Jung and the classical psychoanalytic. Doesn't matter why it's that way. The question is, how are you going to get from here to there? And that's what Edinger was trying to express in that quote. I think that's the other little thing, maybe. To 70, she just refers to the image of seven women. Top of 270. Now, we don't know from the quote we just read that there are seven daughters of Zion, but we find out in the next paragraph that there's seven of them. And seven would be the number of planets. And that certainly would have been known in Hebrew times, I think, through astrology. Do you know when seven planets in astrology, right?
Originally
from Babylonian times.
Those
are
the visible ones.
Yeah. So why when she says in Aurora it is top of 270, third sentence, in Aurora it is seven women who suffer the imprisonment. They are all the planetary powers of the earth. What does that mean? It actually comes up.
I think it comes by the seven spirits of God. Are those all connected, or are these all like the seven? It always seems around.
And I think this is not Judeo-Christian.
Well, no, I was getting it from. Oh, I don't know where. I mean, just we were talking about something.
This is Babylonian.
Okay.
But why? How do we understand the meaning of seven? It's right out of the Sophia.
The number of dead is seven.
That's Christian.
Yeah, but actually that probably has its base on the seven planetary powers.
So seven is the number that's seeking completion in eight?
Yeah, I think this is all earlier than that. Oh. Well, I don't know for sure. This is just my sense. That
power in eight and completion in nine.
No, I think this is simply a reflection of Babylonian cosmology. The The idea was that each planet was a metal. And that, I kind of forget which is which, like Mars is iron, Venus is
copper.
Mercury. I can't remember what all is what. But that...
Saturn is lead.
Saturn is lead, right. You get the idea, anyway.
I think Jupiter is... And I don't know where that came from, but I think it is.
Jupiter might be 10, yeah. The idea is that the heavenly planets were each connected with a metal. And those seven metals made up seven principles of the human being. So that the seven aspects of life defined by the seven metals. And that's what astrology is working with, basically. You know, that if this is in Venus, then that's your love life. And so in the alchemical equivalent, that would be your copper would be your love life, and your lead would be your depression, and your quicksilver would be your quixotic nature, and so on. But they are in the medieval mind, or in the astrological mind, we have these characteristics because they are also characteristics of the earth. So that the human being's personality is paralleled to the nature of the physical constituents of the earth. Is this making any sense? Now, what's that to do with Sophia? What it has to do with Sophia is it shows the link between the earth and this experience. So these seven daughters of Zion are the seven earthly appetites, you might say. Again, emphasizing the instinctual or the desirous nature of the Sophia experience. That's what I think the link is between the seven daughters, the seven metals being aspects of the personality shaped by the heavens, which are at the same time the reason we have seven appetites is because there are seven metals on earth.
Right. Even down here in the bottom of page 270, it says, talks about the seven were regarded as, I don't know, demons and the seven deadly sins.
Yeah. So that each sin would probably be connected with one planet.
Right.
But you see, what is stressed here is the worldliness. That's what I'm trying to get at. These seven women are the seven aspects of our worldliness, which are, on the one hand, undesirable, sinners, and on the other hand, as we'll see in a moment, the doors to salvation. And... That's, let me just try one more passage and then we'll wrap it up. Bottom of 270. In that day, when seven women took hold of one man, so there they are, the spirits of the metals, which are the spirit of your worldliness, which is bad, but at the same time they're reaching for unity. So again, the irony or the reversal of values is present. Seven women took hold of one man, saying, "We eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Why dost thou not defend our blood, which is poured out as water round about Jerusalem. Let me just stop there. That is a reference to Revelation, to the blood of the martyrs, which is poured out and will be redeemed at the end of time. So you have explicitly, they are sinners in one phrase, and they are martyrs who have suffered for God on the other. Which is, again, the ambivalence of the Sophia experience. It is both sinful and saving at the same time. And they receive the divine reply. So this sinful aspect is what opens up the door to divine intervention. In other words, to the generative aspect of the psyche, to the transcendent function, if you will, to the intent of the instinct. Rest ye a little time, until the number of our brethren is filled up, which is written in this book. As Von Franz says, there are 6 lines down. They are thus sinners and martyrs at once.
Reading from Von Franz and the cat, whatever, about the Carol Moore fairy tale and the cat. I forget the name of the book. I just got. But anyways, one thing I got really.
Might be the cat.
But it was really great because she talks about depression being that she really isn't trusting anything she writes unless it comes out of a depression, which was really positive for me to hear that. That was great.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Who's this one?
Von Franz.
She has a book called The Cat, I think. Just called The Cat. Is it Inner City, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interpretation of fairy tales about cats. Well, let's see. We got through about 3 pages today. But I felt it was important to give you examples. Hopefully we will not proceed at that pace all the time. We're kind of speeding up, but... that takes us through page 271. And I think I'd ask you to read up to 287. And you'll probably read to the end of the fourth parable over the break, so you'll be a little bit ahead, which is to 3. Well, is that too much to read, maybe?
Yeah, that's too much to read.
That's too much. Yeah, let's see. 287. Yeah, I think if you read to 297, you'll be all right. We're not going to get that far.
So we don't come back to 13?
We don't meet in 2 weeks, but we'll meet in 4 weeks.
Okay. Great.
Have a happy holiday, everybody. Thanks again for
you.
For the spirit.
Sounds very good.